could you sit down? In the first talk, I spoke about will and consciousness and function, about the instrument which is seen in what it does, that is, in its functions, the state in which things are done, compared it to light, and said we can look at consciousness as the state which determines the quality and the wholeness, the integrity of what we're doing, and the will, which is the transmission of the power by which the world is maintained, it transmits through us, through our will, and transmits through everything. Now, today, we want to come to this in connection with our own human structure. We first of all have to think of the kinds of instruments that we have, that we are provided with, and by looking at these instruments then we'll be able to say something about functions. But we can't separate this from the will, because they will work differently. Last time, for example, we spoke about energy, and I said that attention is a totally different thing when the will is dominating in it and when the will is subordinate. When the will is subordinate, everything attracts our attention and we depend upon things to stimulate and interest and drive us. But when the will is dominant, then our attention is positive, voluntary. We attend to what we choose to attend to. So that the same thing of attention is very different according to where the will is working in it. Take another, before I come to give you a systematic picture of it. Let's take various things to look at. We have a power of thought. This also can work very differently. It is an instrument. It can work under the domination of our bodies, according to the state of our nervous system, according to the state of the chemistry of our blood. It can be influenced, even dominated by sensations, by what we see and hear, and by the state of our organism. If we're in an active, healthy state, we have one kind of thought, and in a sick state, another kind of thought. In this case, thought is weak, passive, but it's possible to have something quite different, where thought has a creative power, where a mental image is created independently of what is outside or of our own state. This can then directly express our own will, as with attention, when the creative energy is directly connected with our will, we are in command. The same way, when our thinking is working under the direct command of our will, it is creative. We see, we create mental images. And we have to learn, and we are beginning to learn something about this. Also possible for our thinking to be dominated by a higher will than our own. Then we have revelation, visions, illuminations. So although it is the same instrument by which mental images are formed, that instrument can work in very different ways. So it's not enough just to study the instrument and what it's able to do. We also have to study how it works under different conditions. Because these instruments are very different from our man-made instruments, which do more or less the same work. They do the same work better or worse, according to whether they're skilled or unskilled hand is using them. But these instruments of ours have much greater range of possibilities. The same is true of our feelings, that feelings can be very mechanical. They can be just emotional reactions, and we can in our feelings be in a state of slavery, unable to think or do what we want because our emotions are in control. It's possible also to learn how to control this energy of feeling. But it's possible to go still deeper, because the feelings can penetrate into depths of reality that are beyond what we can see or even what we can think about. We can not only feel what it's like, let us say, to be a tree or to be a sheep, but we can feel greater things beyond what can be seen through our senses. It is almost impossible to arrive at what a man truly is by thought, but it's possible to feel what this human nature is that has been present on this earth for so many thousands of years and has such a very high destiny. What we think about it will always be taken from ordinary things. When something catches our feelings and we are feelings opened into something deeper, then we feel very differently. Very often we feel how great is the contradiction between the state in which we are and the level on which we live and what might be possible for us and what is destined for us. And yet we don't know this by thought. We just feel how big a task there is in front of man, if only he can take it on. How is it that we have these different kinds of perceptions and actions? We talk, even without this particular approach that we are following now, but people certainly do distinguish between thought and feeling and the working of the body. And we can say at once that we can make this distinction, and it is a necessary one. And this is certainly one aspect of what is meant by saying man is a three-brained being. But now, today, we have to come to something more explicit, plainer. What do we mean by brains? What would we mean by this man is a three-brained being? How does this division into thought, feeling and sensation, or mind and feeling and body, how does it connect with the other division into three, that is of will and consciousness and function? I did say that the will of man is more associated with his head brain, and consciousness in man is more associated with his feelings and his being, more characteristically, more typically present in his feelings, and that the bodily side is more connected with function. But it wouldn't be right to say that that we will with our mind, that we are conscious with our feelings and that we do everything with our bodies, because clearly in the working of the mind there is an instrument. There is an instrument in the working of the feelings. Both are just as much instruments as in the case of the body. So we have functions that are closer to the will, functions that are closer to the consciousness and to the being, and functions that are merely functional, almost exclusively just instrumental. Looking at the perfected man, the man who's in whom all the different sides of his nature are developed and balanced, it can be said that his will has become one will, one individuality, and the place of this is in his head brain. And it is possible to say that he has one being, one force, one single driving power in him, one consciousness, and this is the seat of this is in his feeling brain. And it's possible to say that he has a complete range of instruments, all coordinated so that they work in harmony with one another, and these are associated with his body. But this is not enough. You have also to take into account that with any man, perfected or unperfected, there are different levels of functioning. Even the perfected man doesn't live the whole of his life on this earth in the highest state of consciousness. This would be impossible and even stupid, because the highest state of consciousness is for certain very special purposes, to bring man in contact with the cosmic purpose, to enable him to communicate with God. It would be wasteful and foolish if he were to use the same consciousness for dealing with material objects, and therefore it would be in any case wrong to have always the same level of functioning. And furthermore, no one is so perfect that everything is according to the ideal. Even the fully developed man has incompleteness in himself, but he wouldn't be in general also right that he should be completed and perfect here, because this belongs to another state of existence. Therefore, we have to take that into account, and of course even more so in dealing with what we, with ourselves, with what we can know, that so far from living the whole time on the highest level, or having our functions coordinated, or having a single state of consciousness, we can see that we're extremely far from all these things. And therefore, for us, this becomes a very important question, not merely what kind of work is being done, but on what level is it being done. Today we're going to talk about just how this human instrument is made, how it is created so as to work and to do what is possible and what this man is destined for. We leave to another study all the ways in which this goes wrong and how we can set about putting it right. So much that I shall be saying today doesn't directly apply, because I shall be talking about how it ought to be, whereas we have to deal very much with how it is and how we're to understand what's wrong with it and how to put it right. So although I will not be talking about the perfected man, I will be talking about an idealized man, or a man, how man is made. what he has provided with, not for the very exceptional people who are born with higher powers and directly in contact with higher worlds, nor for people whose existence on this earth is particularly restricted because of defects in their bodies and in their functions and so on, and who can't be understood without reference to other states of existence. Insofar as one can use the word normal, and it's not a very good word to use for the most part, we're going to be talking about normal man, or ordinary man even. Let me first of all speak to you about this word center or brain, which is Gurdjieff's expression when he talks about a man as a three-brained being. Well, the key to understanding this is in another phrase that Gurdjieff uses very often in Beelzebub's tales, and that is where he refers to spiritualized parts, in all spiritualized parts, or in all three spiritualized parts. He sometimes uses it so as to make it clear that when he says spiritualized parts, he's talking about the same thing as a brain or a center. Not that they are just interchangeable words, they just put the emphasis on a different aspect, but the aspects of the same thing. By spiritualized, we mean in which there is will, that is, in which there is a direction and the possibility of choosing. There is a will in the body. The will in the body does not work in the way that our thinking does. It doesn't connect past and future and make plans, remember things, learn from other people from the outside, use language, all sorts of things that we connect with a brain. The will in the body is the urge to live, to realize this life here on this earth, here in this body. The will to live is partly the will to preserve, maintain, nourish, and the rest of it, this body, and partly the will to act, to do things to the outside world. And this with us people means that we have really two wills in the body. One of these we call the instinctive will, which is the same exactly as it is in other animals. And the other we call the moving will, which is different, which animals have to a much less degree, because most of their external activity is connected with the preservation of life. But we wish to change the world outside us, to adapt it to ourselves. We have our instruments, particularly our hands, that are primarily, almost entirely, for the purpose of acting on the world round us. We can vary our ways of locomotion. We can not only walk and run, but we can also get into the water and swim. We can climb. We can crawl. We can move over the surface of the earth in most of the ways that animals can, with the exception, important exception, of the power of the birds and some insects to fly. But this gives us this possibility of varying the ways in which we move about and adapting ourselves. Gives us an advantage over animals, which in general have only one form of running and walking, flying, swimming, crawling, climbing, jumping. This is because the will in man is different from the will in animals, because even connected with the body, the will is more creative than it is with animals. Now, the difficult thing that I want to convey to you here is that this will connected with the body doesn't look forward. It doesn't look back. It is concerned with the present. Whereas what we usually think of as will is the intention to do something and to choose something for the sake of some result in the future, or in order to adapt ourselves to something that's happened in the past. And when we think of there being a will in the body, we should suppose it like that. But this kind of will that looks forwards and backwards belongs to another part. It belongs to the head brain. There isn't really in the body an urge to know about the world. Its urge is to act. To act, first of all, to maintain life, but also to act upon the environment that it is able to reach. This urge to act, when it cooperates with the head brain, of course, produces the kind of life that we know about, where we're trying to make things and do things and accomplish results and using our instruments with our eyes and hands and the rest. But what is in the body alone is much simpler. And in order to understand this brain in the body, we have to learn not to look at it as if it were a kind of inferior head brain, able to do the same sort of things but not so well, because it hasn't got abstract ideas or hasn't got means of memorizing and or anticipating, expecting and looking to the future. To understand this body brain, we have to learn to look at it as it is in itself, as it works in itself. It has got two halves to it, or two ways of working, one which is for its own maintenance and the other is for its outward action. And those Gurdjieff calls the instinctive center and the moving center. But they are both associated with the body. They're associated also with a part of the nervous system that doesn't have the apparatus of memory connected with it, that is the spinal column, and some parts of the head brain which don't deal with this power of recall. Things are registered, things are known there, but it's not the kind of memory that we have, where we say, I remember what I did yesterday, or I can look forward to what I'm going to do tomorrow. Because of this, that we have to train the body differently. And we're beginning in these exercises we're doing in the morning, just at this very moment, it is connected with that, of training the body to do things through sensation, and by associating sensation with the power of vision, which belongs to the mind, not to the body. There's another difference between the two parts of the body brain, and that is that one is provided more or less complete before and by the time we are born, so that even at the moment of birth we're able at once to breathe with no possibility of anyone teaching us to breathe. And yet this great change that has to come, where one breathes through one's mother and one breathes oneself, this has to be done or there will be no life. And nobody to teach it and no means of learning it. Therefore, this has to be prepared so that this extraordinary act of will to breathe is done without any thought, without any learning, and it continues throughout life. We can have a certain amount of consciousness brought into it after a few years, and good deal can be done by associating consciousness with breathing, but breathing in itself is an instinctive function, but it is a function connected with a very strong will. If we're deprived of air, something stops, prevents our breathing, everything will go in order to breathe. Though it is you, with the illustration I'm taking for that reason, that you can see that although this is not the kind of thing that we ordinarily regard as an act of will, it is in reality a very strong, and the will can be total. When it is a moment of suffocation, everything disappears except the need to breathe. Or even if we're deprived and short of breath, everything else disappears. That kind of unity and total commitment in one's will is only really in the instinctive center until something is very much changed in other parts of us. So you see, there's no lack of will in the instinctive center, but it's not what we would ordinarily regard as will, because we regard as will seeing something and wanting it and doing something about it. There's another powerful will connected with the body, and that is the sexual will. And this is a powerful, not so powerful as breathing, but it is powerful. So there are really three ways in which the will works in the body. There are all the working that maintains the life of the body. There is all the ways in which we act on the outside world, and there's also that everything that's connected with this particular power of sexual reproduction, which works in a special way and has to be studied quite separately from the others, because it uses a higher energy. Then the next thing I think to look at is the head brain. This is the one with which we think ourselves most familiar. In reality, we have no idea, and even all the experts in this do not understand what is the real power of the head, of this instrument that we have, that we call our head brain. It is the one that really gives us the highest of our possibilities, because it is through the head brain that the final act of choice is made by which man chooses his ultimate destiny. And the ultimate choice for man is whether to be himself or to be God. That ultimately is the thing, to be separate and live for oneself, or to choose to become one with the will that governs the whole world. This is what man is allowed to do. He can choose to be separate, and he can choose to be united. But for that, many things have to come, and many, many things have to be developed in him. But finally, the moment comes when he is able to see that either he must disappear or God must disappear. This is what the highest, highest moment of the head brain. It is very high indeed. There are many very high functions that we know almost as little about, connected with the head brain. The ability to see what the world is about, to see what is happening in this world, what it is really doing. This is also possible for man. These things are what Gurdjieff calls objective reason. And he speaks of different gradations of objective reason. And of course, with each gradation of objective reason, there is a certain kind of will, more or less complete. On our way to this, we have to develop powers, power that we've spoken about, the power of seeing. This vision comes to all of us in glimpses. One can see that it is quite differently related to time from ordinary thinking. One sees in a flash, in a moment, and what one sees is really there. There is no doubt. But the same head brain also has quite ordinary functions. It is particularly its power to deal with the external world, because it is able to recognize on a quite low and ordinary level how the world works. One can see what one can do with different materials, what kind of instruments can be made, how these instruments are to be used. And then in this same head brain, there develops a dream life where mental images just automatically form. Pictures, very often words, talk, inner conversations, as it were, this one screen on which the picture can be thrown. But what different kinds of pictures? The very highest, the very most ordinary, and also below ordinary, destructive and harmful pictures. Now, how does the will work in the head brain? There is not the same compulsive force in our thinking processes as there are in our instinctive processes. There's nothing in thinking that has the same immediate power as, let us say, the need to breathe. We do have the will to know, the curiosity, and it is an important part of our equipment. It is one working of the will in the brain, is this impulse or urge to know. And it can drive us all over the world. Looking plays a great part in man's life. But it hasn't the same sort of immediate power over us. But it is the same. There is the same urge. Only it's running, flowing through another channel in this case. This urge to know, this curiosity, is a need for things to make sense, to connect. Some state of dissatisfaction exists in us because things aren't connected, and we find that we need. When this works quite automatically, mechanically in us, it simply produces vulgar curiosity, just to satisfy our own egoism. But it also produces a quite mechanical and automatic flow of association. Now let's say something about the third brain. As I said before, the third brain, connected with feeling, is also closer to our being. It is possible, providing one's very careful how one says it, to say the head brain is the will brain, the feeling brain is the being brain, and the body is the function brain. I say you have to be careful, because clearly there are feeling functions and mental functions too. But it's on the whole like that. One can distinguish between curiosity, this is as a mental urge, that the urge to know, and the hunger for being, the sense of dissatisfaction that something is lacking in us. Our need for other people is very different from the need to know about other people, curiosity about people. With curiosity we can be very much separated from people, but with feeling we come close to them. One of the things that you have noticed, and we've brought out a number of times in when we've been here together, is that we feel closer to one another when we are silent than when we have to talk. In talking, we bring the head brain into action and we communicate, but in that we remain separate from one another. When we sit silently together, if we're not altogether wrapped up in our own inner associations and allow ourselves to feel one another, then quite different connection comes. A connection that doesn't depend upon knowing. It is a direct awareness of other people. This is why being and consciousness are so closely connected with one another. The will in the feelings is the will towards union. This is why it leads to love, and why love is in truth the highest level in the feeling. But this other simple feeling, this feeling of longing to have something substantial in oneself, this sense of one's inner emptiness and longing to be filled, or sense of loneliness and wanting to have something, some kind of assurance that one has a place in the world. These are genuine feelings, that, and that they are an expression of the will in the feelings. If you're able to recognize these, then you can see that there is that kind of will. It is from this will that we have the drive for completion, the drive for unity, both in ourselves to overcome this sense of inner emptiness, and also in with others to be able to feel that we really belong together. There are, of course, the mechanical, automatic feelings, just as there are mechanical thoughts. All this working of like and dislike belongs to the mechanical part of the feeling brain. This is without being negative, without going into the kind of emotions that are unnecessary and that are grafted onto us simply by bad environmental conditions that in general can be to some extent heredity, but they're not necessary. They're a fault of our life. I'm not talking about those. I said I would talk about all the troubles that we are up against in our psychological working as something separate. I'm talking today about the ordinary, natural, normal structure of a human being. There is in a normal man that urge to be, this urge to come closer to other people, to overcome his inner emptiness, to fulfill his destiny, the need for confidence, the need for assurance that the world or the power that rules the world is friendly towards us. all those are the working of the will in the feeling brain. There are other things about it too. I'm only telling you things that just happen to occur to me as I'm speaking. No attempt to give you a sort of systematic, comprehensive picture. We can say that we have in the three brains, brain of the body, or as Goethe calls it, the instinctive moving, the brain of the mind, the intellectual brain, and the feeling, or he calls it sometimes the emotional center. And that is also connected with the body, the sex center. It's also possible to divide the emotional brain according to whether it is a feeling of need and actions that concern this world, or whether it is something that is reaching up to higher worlds and higher levels of being and consciousness. And Gurdjieff makes that division into what he calls the lower emotional and the higher emotional. I'm telling you all this because, having given you this kind of general introduction, I'm just going to put what may be familiar to some of you, but everyone needs to see it, the diagram that Gurdjieff introduced in his talks in Russia during the First World War, he did continue, and I saw him using this same diagram in the Prière in 1923, but it doesn't appear, for example, in his own writings, in Beelzebub's Tales or his other writings. So he did not continue to use this. And it may mainly thanks to Uspensky that this way of presenting it has been preserved. But it is useful, and Gurdjieff certainly did not abandon it, because at the end of his life he did use this and did speak about the centers. And I myself, in all the many years, the many long years since I first heard about it, have found it enormously valuable, both for understanding my own nature and for talking with other people about psychological questions. But the one thing that I'm saying to you that doesn't appear in these books is that you have to understand that a brain here is not just a collection of functions. The instinctive brain is not just the working of the heart and the circulatory and the respiratory and digestive systems and the nervous system and so on. It's not a physiological thing. It is a spiritualized part. That means it is a will. It is a will that is at the center of our instinctive life, just as there is a will at the center of our outward active life. And there is a will at the center of our feeling life. And it is that is the reason for calling it a center. The reason for calling it a spiritualized part is to emphasize that it's not just the particular instrument or the activity, but it is that it is associated with a will. And the reason why it's called a brain is that it is also a seat of intelligent action. There is an intelligence connected with the body, with the mind, and with the feelings. So that we can say we're three brain beings, in the sense that we have three different kinds of intelligence. We're three centered beings, in the sense that our will is located in three different groups of activity. And we have spiritualized parts, in the sense that we have different functions for different purposes. But I must say once again that now I'm talking about the normal man, not man perfected, but the normal man who is as he should be. And we do not grow up like that. And we grow up without a unified will, except possibly in the instinctive brain. And where we are most lacking in a single will is in our feelings. Our wills, our feelings are not united. And that's how it comes about that our feelings are so unstable, and how it is that we're not able to feel different things at the time. Or very seldom we have this feeling of, let's say, sadness and joy together. Now the way Gurdjieff presented it in these talks that in Moscow, which Gurdjieff reproduced, which I've become accustomed to over all these years, is to talk of also a third and yet one more way of man as a three-storied being, and to say that there is a top story which is the head, a middle story which is the feelings, and a lower story which is the instinctive moving and sex centers. And he puts it on, he made this diagram, which most of you will have seen, but the diagram represents a side view of man, this part of it being his face here, and his eyes and nose and mouth being there. As you see when we use this same diagram for dealing with the transformation of food and air. And we speak about his having the head brain in its ordinary working, and the head brain when it is conscious and when the will are together. This he calls the higher intellectual center. This the lower. He speaks of the emotions also as the middle center, of the emotional center, and the higher. And he speaks of the instinctive moving and sex. That makes altogether seven centers. These can all be grouped together: body centers, these are feeling centers, and these are intellectual. And that way you get three centers, or three stories, and you also can divide into seven. The division into seven is artificial, but it's useful for talking about things, because nearly everything that we can observe in our study of ourselves belongs to these, to this part. We can certainly learn a lot about the moving center. We learn a lot about the ordinary working of the emotions and the ordinary working of the mind. Perhaps we shall have a study, special study of the sex functions in man, the role of sex in our lives. And I have great hopes that something will come also that will enable us to talk about these higher centers. I've certainly left Tony with a nice job of saving all these things, because I've sketched it in very, very hastily in this way at the end, because I wanted you to come to it with this realization that that the reason why we speak of man as a three-brain being is that the urges in us flow through different channels, and it is the urge to live, the urge to be, the need to be, and also the urge to understand, to find out, to be able to see. These are the things that make us three-brained beings. When they become united in us, then we can say we have one will. You also perhaps can understand why Gurdjieff says that the problem of our transformation, of our development, is that we are not at the starting point, that people try to get somewhere without having reached the starting point. The starting point is a normal person such as I've described to you. But people are not that. They haven't got an integrated intellectual or emotional life. They haven't even got these normal urges. They have all sorts of other ones. In that scale of man that Gurdjieff makes, four, seven levels of man, and he says the man whose life is dominated by his body is man number one, man who's dominated by his feelings is man number two, and the man who's dominated by his intellectual function is man number three, and that the man who is balanced and who knows what he wants and has a clear purpose in life is called man number four. But he is the first time you can speak of a normal man. When we've reached this stage, which is the stage of this description here, of this picture that I've been giving you, so I've been really giving you a picture not of man as he as ordinarily is, but of man who has already come to the level of man number four. Because that is the way to look at man. Then afterwards we can see what is it that is preventing us from being that. Once we have seen this, then we can look beyond to see how does one go to superhuman levels. And what does all that mean? So now we can break this off, go for tea, and we'll pick up this terminology and we go on to something else next week.